Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we plunge headfirst into the fascinating stories behind the things you thought you knew. Today, we're stepping into a world you almost certainly seen before. Even if, maybe, the artist's name isn't right there on the tip of your tongue. I'm talking about those iconic matchstick men, you know the ones. Those little figures, often sort of anonymous, moving through these stark industrial landscapes. They're really part of our visual memory, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Instantly recognizable. And the mind behind them. That was Lawrence Stephen Lowry. L.S. Lowry, born in Stretford, November 1st, 1887. And his career, really prolific, ended with his death in 1976. He left behind this, well, immense artistic legacy. We're talking around 1,000 paintings and, get this, over 8,000 drawings.
Wow, 8,000 drawings. That's just incredible. So for this deep dive, our mission really is to journey through Lowry's life. Try and understand where his unique style came from. And we'll explore some of his most famous works, paintings, and prints. Some are, as you'll find out, incredibly valuable now. We're not just listing facts here. We want to peel back the layers, you know, reveal the hidden depths, the enduring appeal of his work, and figure out how his own experiences really shaped that vision. Why, even now, in 2025, his pieces fetch millions.
It's fascinating, actually, how deeply his early life and surroundings became the bedrock of his art. He apparently had a rather unhappy childhood. Reports mention a difficult relationship with his mother, and his father, though well-meaning, was somewhat distant.
Right. That sounds like a tough start. It makes you wonder if those surroundings, the industrial landscape, became almost a kind of refuge.
Exactly. More than just a distraction. When the family moved to Pendlebury in 1909, that was, well, pivotal. It really shaped his path. He didn't just look. He studied the industrial world around him, almost finding meaning, maybe solace in the mills, the chimneys, the crowds. And that intense observation, it just stamped itself onto his work. You see it everywhere. Sadly, that period also involved deep depression, especially after his father died in 32 and then his mother in 39. You can sort of feel that melancholy, that solitude under the surface in a lot of his paintings.
Yeah, that weight of loss.
Yeah.
It's palpable. But it's interesting, isn't it? This very private man, pouring emotion onto canvas, also had some quirks and a specific way of connecting or not connecting. I mean, he famously said, aged 88, that he'd never had a woman.
It's quite a statement. And maybe speaks to a deliberate choice, perhaps a total devotion to his art above all else. But he wasn't a hermit, not at all. He had close friendships with other artists, men and women, like Sheila Fell, for instance. A landscape artist. He really supported her career, bought lots of her paintings, and he was friends with the Salford artists like Harold Riley, James Lawrence Isherwood. So definitely part of a creative circle.
And this detail always gets me. He was apparently a great storyteller, loved spinning yarns, but the stories were often, well, hard to verify.
Mm.
Or sometimes he'd even deliberately mislead people. A bit mischievous.
Definitely adds another layer, doesn't it? A complex character, maybe controlling his own narrative in life as well as art. Now, thinking about his artistic development, his formal training began in 1905. He studied under Pierre-Adolphe Fillet, a French impressionist, at the Manchester School of Art.
Ah, impressionism. So capturing light, fleeting moments, visible brushstrokes, that whole French movement. Feels quite different from the Lowry we know, the starker style.
Mm.
How did he get from that to the, well, the matchstick men?
Well, it was a conscious evolution, really, a refinement. Initially, yes, his industrial scenes had a darker, more impressionist feel, but then he started using lighter backgrounds, often quite muted. And that wasn't just aesthetic, it was a choice. It made his figures, those mysterious matchstick men, stand out more sharply, almost like silhouettes. His signature style, the urban landscapes packed with figures, it's all deeply rooted in that industrial upbringing we talked about. But here's a twist. Despite how different they look, he apparently considered the Pre-Raphaelite artist Rossetti his main inspiration.
Rossetti? Wow, the Pre-Raphaelite. Known for those rich, detailed, almost medieval scenes? That is surprising. So the connection wasn't about the look, the style. Something else.
Exactly. It wasn't about copying Rossetti's colors or subjects. The Pre-Raphaelites, you know, mid-19th century, they focused on narrative, strong emotion, detailed realism, like early Italian art. So Lowry likely saw something in Rossetti's dedication to storytelling on canvas, to giving figures emotional weight, even in a crowd. And the sheer craft of it, he was tapping into that lineage just in his own radically different industrial context. It shows he was looking deeper.
That really does reframe things. Okay, so we have the man, his background, his artistic roots. How will we dive into some of the paintings themselves, see how it all comes together? Let's start with that pulse of industrial life he's so famous for.
Good place to start. The Mill, Pendlebury, from 1943. It's really significant. One of his first proper goes at an industrial scene. And it's more than just a picture. It shows his ability to find this stark, maybe melancholic beauty in those structures. You see his hometown, a smallish crowd, terrace houses, and then the massive Acme Spinning Company mill just looming there, billowing chimneys, big factories all around. It's like a monument to that whole era. And it sold for 2.7 million pounds, more than double the estimate, which tells you something about how much it resonates.
It shows its importance. And then Industrial Landscape from 44. That one feels even bleaker to me. Those tiny figures just dwarfed by it all.
You're right. It's quite haunting. A real industrial wasteland. The figures are almost swallowed up by the scale of it all. Murky gray tones. Even the river looks contaminated. And he famously claimed, and it was proven true, that he only used 5 colors for works like this. That wasn't just, you know, a limitation. It was a choice. Stripping away color forced you to confront the grim reality, the mood. It creates this almost universal gray landscape. That one sold for 2.6 million pounds back in 2011. Still a huge sum.
And coming from the mill, 1930, that's pure Lowry, isn't it? You see it, you know it's him. Those matchstick figures heading home from the factory, like a tide of people. The grays and browns just nail that industrial mood.
Absolutely. A classic example of him capturing that daily rhythm, the collective life in those towns. And while we mostly think of his paintings, it's worth mentioning Bandstand from 1924. It's a pencil drawing. Different medium, but same distinctive figures, same industrial backdrop. Shows how consistent his vision was even early on.
He really owned those industrial scenes. Okay, let's pivot a bit. From the factory rhythm to crowds, spectacles, and urban narratives. Lowry was amazing at painting people gathering, often for specific events, finding something universal in it all. Going to the Match from 1953. For many people, this is the Lowry painting.
It really is iconic. It captures that buzz, that huge crowd of football fans outside a stadium just before the game. And the genius is in the ambiguity. No clear faces, no team colors. So it becomes about all football matches, you know, that shared experience. People think it might be Burnden Park, Bolton Wanderers' old ground near where he lived. But its real power is that universality.
And the story of this painting is just incredible. It broke records, didn't it? It sold for, what was it, 7.8 million pounds in October 2022. It was the most expensive ever. But the best part is, after a big campaign, it's back home at the Lowry in Salford for everyone to see. It was fantastic.
A huge moment, yeah. For art, for heritage. And related to that, there's the Football Match from 1949. Another brilliant piece. Shows the game itself, crowds watching, again with factories and chimneys in the background. It makes you think, doesn't it? How often our leisure, our fun, is still framed by the working world we're trying to escape for a bit.
And he was a Manchester City fan himself, wasn't he? You can kind of feel that personal connection, the genuine excitement of a weekend match. It shows how much those collective moments meant to him. That one also went for a lot, 4.5 million pounds. People love these scenes.
They really do. And not all his crowd scenes were huge events. A town square from 1953 is different, more intimate. It gives you a closer look at city life. You can actually make out some expressions here. There's even a man in the middle looking right at you. It draws you in, makes an ordinary scene feel quite captivating. Lowry himself said, "A street is not a street without people." This painting really shows that, doesn't it? It sold for 2.5 million pounds.
That quote sums him up perfectly. And then, moving away from the north, Piccadilly Circus, London, from 1943, one of his few London scenes. What's special about this one?
It's a fascinating change of location, but still pure Lowry in how it captures that human buzz. You've got the famous landmark packed with people, busy traffic, those red buses, even details like Coca-Cola signs. People praised its detail, how it captured the energy of a huge city. Shows his style could work anywhere, really, not just the industrial north. That sold for $5.6 million back in 2011.
Right, from city bustle to pure celebration. Let's look at our final theme. Fairs, festivities, and the unseen power of nature. Lowry wasn't all gray factories. He could capture pure joy. And even, surprisingly, the power of nature. Good Friday, Daisy Nook, 1946. That feels much lighter, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. And historically important, too. It depicts the first Good Friday after World War II ended. So it just radiates the sense of optimism, of relief, a huge crowd at an Easter fair. And even though you don't see faces clearly, the details, kids with balloons, bright tents, They conveyed this real feeling of high spirits, community joy after the war. It sold for £3.8 million in 2007. People really connect with that feeling.
And he obviously liked Daisy Nook. He painted the fair again in Fun Fair Daisy Nook in 1953. Similar vibe?
Very similar. Same energy, colorful crowds at the annual Easter Fair. You can even spot specific rides, like the Silicock Bros Thriller. Shows his sustained interest in these moments of collective fun. That one went for $3.4 million in 2011.
These fair scenes are great contrast to the mills. Shows his range. What about a Northern Race meeting from 1956? You said that showed a shift.
A slight shift, yeah. It shows a more relaxed group at a race course. The view is closer, more elevated, gives it a sort of stage-like feel. And importantly, the faces are a bit clearer here. You get more sense of individual expressions, emotions, maybe suggests he was evolving, getting more interested in individuals within the crowd. It sold for £5.2 million in 2018.
And then, perhaps the biggest surprise for some, his connection with nature. People might forget this side. The sea from 1964 is stunning.
It really is. So serene, but powerful. It captures the vastness of the ocean. That close-up high viewpoint makes you feel like you're right there. It's got this calm water, but the sky is hazy. Hints at change, at the sea's unpredictability. Lowry loved the sea. He actually called it the battle of life. Found it endlessly fascinating how it could be calm one minute, wild the next. Like life itself, a really powerful, quite minimalist piece. Sold for £2.7 million just in 2022.
And we should briefly mention Portrait of Anne from 1957. Famous, mysterious, lots of theories about who Anne was, but no one really knows, right?
Exactly. Never confirmed. Just adds to the whole Lowry enigma, the personal mystery surrounding him. But if you pull all these threads together, his whole body of work, from the Stark Mills to the football crowds, the fairs, the sea, it consistently captures the spirit of everyday life, the human condition, in Britain in the mid-20th century.
So what does it all mean? Why do these matchstick figures, these landscapes, still hit home so hard? Why the huge prices? It feels like it's more than just painting, doesn't it? It's storytelling, symbolism, connecting with ordinary moments.
Precisely. His huge legacy, all those works.
Yeah.
It comes down to an artist who could find something extraordinary in the everyday, the mundane. Lowry didn't just paint what he saw. He painted how he felt about it. He distilled complex things, society, individual feelings, into these symbols everyone gets. Think about the anonymity in going to the match becomes about all of us that share joy. Or the five colors and industrial landscape stripping it back forces you to confront the starkness. The environment becomes the character itself.
It's been a really profound journey through his world. From that tough childhood to this unique vision. He didn't just paint the industrial north. He transformed it, made the mundane magnificent, gave us a way to look at our own lives, maybe.
And that's his genius, isn't it? Capturing universal truths in very specific places. That's why the work still feels so powerful, so relevant today.
So maybe next time you're watching a crowd or just see someone walking alone, lost in thought, perhaps you'll see them slightly differently through Lowry's eyes. Will you wonder about their story or see something universal reflected there? We hope this deep dive encourages you to, well, look for the art in the everyday. Just like Lowry did, find the meaning in the world around you.